Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. You know, this morning I did my morning run, and as I came back to the house, there sitting on the bird bath was a dragonfly. And easy to identify, although there's, I think, over 6,000 species, so I couldn't tell you which species it was. But even if you don't know much about insects, I'll bet you can identify a dragonfly. We've got a lot, though, that we can learn about dragonflies, and you're going to learn a lot today as we talk with our guest, Dennis Paulson. He is one of the world's leading experts on dragon and damselflies. He's watched and photographed these charismatic insects on every continent. They're everywhere, and he has a new book out. It's called Dragonflies and Damselflies, A Natural History. So, are these insects a favorite of yours? What questions do you have about their behavior, about their life? Maybe you've got an experience that you can share. Dennis Paulson with us by phone today. Dennis, hi. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure, Larry.
Oh, it's going to be a lot of fun. Your book is beautiful. I really enjoying going through it. What is it about dragonflies and damselflies that caught your attention?
Oh, it's kind of a long story, but it can be summarized that I've been in sort of a naturalist all my life since I was a little kid. And I got to dragonflies fairly late, actually. I was interested in birds and reptiles and amphibians and all sorts of things. And I was in graduate school at the University of Miami quite a while ago, and I was sort of studying fish at the time. And the experiments I was doing with some fish, raising them in the lab, didn't work out. So I was casting around to look for another PhD project. Yeah. And meanwhile, I had gone out with one of my fellow students collecting invertebrates from water hyacinth mats and canals in southern Florida. That was before the alligators got so big. And we a lot of the invertebrates we pulled out of these water hyacinth root mats were dragonflies, and so they're dragonfly larvae. And so I thought, oh, these are cool. Maybe I should learn something about them. Anyway, when my fish experiments failed, I had already been looking at the adult dragonflies for a little while. By that time, I thought, I think I'm going to switch to dragonflies. There's not much known about them in southern Florida where I was. They're a really nice group. They're really interesting behaviorally and ecologically. And there are lots of different kinds, and I really like biodiversity. So, okay, I'll study dragonflies. And that took me on about a four-year project to learn all I could about the dragonflies and damselflies of southern Florida, which ended up in my PhD dissertation. And I've been studying them ever since.
And you've been all over the world. They're everywhere, pretty much.
Yeah, they are. I mean, I go all over the world partly because I'm, again, a gung-ho naturalist, biologist, and nature photographer. And, of course, dragonflies are just about everywhere. They're not in Antarctica. They're not in the high Arctic. But they're everywhere in between. And so, yeah, they're always available to look at, to photograph, to learn about.
And speaking of photographs, the photographs in your book are absolutely amazing. Did you do most of the photography or all of it for your book?
Well, my wife, who goes out with me all the time and loves taking nature photos too, and I did, I think, probably the majority, but there were so many that I didn't have that I had to try to find. And so I would, several books that I've written, I would say perhaps the biggest effort in these books has been to track down photos on birds and dragonflies, both. Originally it would have been very, very difficult. Now you go online, put in a search for a particular dragonfly name, and up pops, you know, a number of photos that have been taken by people in different parts of the world, and you note down the person's name, and you email them and said, could I possibly use your photo for this book? And so laboriously, photo by photo by photo, that's how you get them.
Everybody
is really good at furnishing them.
Oh, man, and I don't even know how many, well, maybe you know, how many photos do you have in this book? It's amazing.
I don't know. I probably knew it one time, but I don't remember now. It's a heck of a lot, as you say. And you try to get them published. Both the publisher and the author wants them published as large as they can possibly be. And so a book of this format is pretty good for that. I've done a number of field guides which weren't as large as this, and so the photos are never as large as you really would like them to be. You'd like them to be, you know, 10 inches high or something to show the, number one, to show the beauty of these animals, number two, to show the field marks that you're trying to show when you're publishing something like a field guide.
Well, and you do have some that are 10 inches.
Yeah, I guess you're right. They're just, there's some full page photos, and I really like that.
Yeah, and you and there's it's a about 200 page book, and I'm sure there are more than 400 photos in the book of various species of dragonflies and damselflies. By the way, you know, somebody's going to say, "What the heck's a what's a damselfly, or how's it different from a dragonfly?"
Sure. Pretty obviously, damselflies have smaller eyes that are separated by more than their own width, so they have sort of a hammer-shaped head with the eyes at both ends. They're much smaller and more slender. I shouldn't say smaller. They're much more slender than dragonflies. Actually, the largest species in the order Odonata, which includes dragonflies and damselflies, is a damselfly with a very, very long abdomen and very, very long wings, but still, you know, is still a damselfly with these eyes well separated. And the wings, the forewings and the hind wings are about the same in damselflies. In dragonflies, the hind wings are distinctly wider than the forewings. So the eye difference in dragonflies have bigger eyes, and they're even touching in many groups. And the wing difference, those are the two things that really define them. And their larvae are different, and other things are different about them. But they're still very, very much members of the same order of insects with very, very similar life history, very similar behavior. They're all predators, not a vegetarian among them. They eat smaller insects. Some of them eat insects as large as they are or larger. And they all have larvae that live in the water, other than maybe a tiny, tiny fraction that have been able to evolve a development on land. And that's the group.
Oh, man. And what species are we likely to see, or do we see in Wisconsin? Do you know offhand?
Well, it would be a huge, long list. Wisconsin's in eastern North America, which is a very, very rich area for dragonflies and damselflies, as it turns out. I don't know what the state list is in Wisconsin, but it's far, far over 100 species. And, you know, you have some really common little blue damselflies called bluettes. There's quite a few species. You have common green darners, which are occur all across the United States and southern Canada. They're a migratory species that comes north in the spring as adults from wintering grounds in the south. Those adults breed, mate, lay eggs. The eggs hatch into larvae that develop in the water. That takes a couple of months in the warm summer waters. They emerge from the water in early autumn and then proceed to fly south to their wintering grounds where they breed, and their larvae develop in turn and emerge and fly north in the spring. So it's actually two different generations in this interesting migration.
That's a fascinating. Rich in La Crescent, Minnesota has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rich. Thank you for calling.
Yes, like many people, I've been plagued with these gnats or black flies this summer.
Yeah.
And watching them fly, they're in a very erratic, haphazard flying motion. Are dragonflies quick enough to pick them off?
I would say they probably are. They eat a tremendous number of small flying insects like black flies, midges, mosquitoes, and they're pretty good at catching them. I mean, I'm sure they miss some, too, just like a bird may miss an insect that it goes after. One thing about it is, as much as I would love to tell you they can control black flies and mosquitoes, they can't. There are just too many of them.
And they're, but they are maneuvering machines, aren't they, those dragonflies?
Yes, they are. They're probably the best flyers among the insects. All four of their wings can be moved independently, not only flapped like a bird, but rotated on their own axis like a propeller. And this allows them to do just about anything in the air. They can stop on a dime. They can go straight up. They can they can hover in a way that sort of they can't fly backwards, but they can sort of reverse their direction by hovering briefly. And they're pretty fantastic flyers. There have been a lot of studies done on dragonflies, actually down to the level of individual neurons, that have shown that they can actually track. People have studied them in the lab having a little tiny ball or a little tiny bead on a string that they pull across in front of the dragonfly, and the dragonfly can track that. Not only can track it, but actually can estimate a a trajectory of the prey, the supposed prey item, and lead it like a hunter leads a duck in flight, and then actually come just to the right spot where that little prey item is going to be in a number of seconds.
Oh, man, that's amazing. Well, so, Rich, they can catch gnats, but not enough probably to satisfy you and a whole lot of other people that get bothered by those gnats. Thank you for calling.
Right.
Trevor in Oak Creek will give you a chance. Hi, Trevor.
Well, hi there. Thanks for having me on the show. I kind of got a neat little story about dragonflies. It's kind of sad, but it's also kind of neat. My daughter, Abby, I lost her to a rare cancer back in 2000, and she was 6 years old.
No.
And she just loved dragonflies. And she'd say, "Daddy, they are such wonderful little creatures." And she loved them so much. And as she was passing away, she said, "Dad, when I get to heaven, I will send you dragonflies to let you know I'm still around." And I got to tell you guys, I've got so many stories, but I have one real quick, and I know I got to be quick to share with you. My son, her brother, is a musician, and he plays in various bands, and he had a tattoo done on his forearm dedicated to his sister. During a outdoor venue, there was probably 400 people there. A dragonfly came in, landed on my wife's shoulder.
Oh.
My wife took her finger, brought it over to her brother, who's on stage playing. He can't stop playing. The dragonfly landed on his forearm and sat there, and he kept playing guitar. And when he was done, it flew to the top of the tent. Is that amazing or what?
Oh, man. Trevor, that's an amazing story.
A wonderful story.
Yeah, and I tell you what, Dennis, we'll have a chance to talk some more about that. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back. We'll talk a little bit more about Trevor's experience and get your interests and comments. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about dragonflies and damselflies, a natural history. That's the title of the book written by Dennis Paulson. He is certainly one of the world's leading experts on dragonflies and damselflies, and so much fun having him on the air to talk about his wonderful book and certainly to talk about the history, the life history of dragonflies and damselflies. And Dennis, just as we were breaking for news, Trevor from Oak Creek called with, I would say, a wonderful story, in some ways kind of a sad story in another way, about his daughter who loved dragonflies passing away, and his and her brother having a tattoo of a dragonfly put on his forearm and then having one land during a concert. And sat right on his forearm after it landed on his mother first. So that was just a wonderful story for me. And dragonflies Trevor's daughter was so taken at a very young age, at 6 years old, by dragonflies. There's something about them that really attracts people, isn't there?
There really is. Trevor's story brought tears to my eyes. Actually, that was just a fantastic story. Mm-hmm. And I hope dragonflies continue to visit his family forever. They're large, they're colorful, they're active in the daytime. The only thing that even vaguely comparable, at least in the insect world, are butterflies, which are also large and colorful and active in the daytime and very diverse. Butterflies are all herbivores or nectar feeders, whereas dragonflies are fierce predators, and I don't know if that's what makes them more interesting to people, the fact that they're going after other insects, and they're, you know, they're so prominent. You should go to the water, because, of course, dragonflies, dragonfly larvae develop in the water, and so the females have to go to the water to lay their eggs, and so the males have to go to the water to find females. So that's really where most of the action is that water. And it can be any sort of water, a pond, a lake, a stream, a river, a seep, a ditch, a bog, a marsh. I mean, anything, any sort of wetlands holds dragonflies. And many of them are habitat specialists. So you'll find that particular species only at that particular habitat. Besides being predators and impressive on the way they actually fly around and catch their prey, they also have a fantastic sex life. This is a family show, so I shouldn't say too much about that, but
I wanted you to talk a little bit about the mating ritual and all that.
Sure. Not too many dragonflies practice courtship as we see in birds and some other animals. Some damselflies do. Some damselflies have very elaborate courtships where the male displays, hovers in front of the female and displays colorful wings or brightly colored legs or some other feature that apparently convinces her that, yes, he's the guy for her. And they mate, but in the vast majority of Odonata, the male just grabs the female, I'm afraid to say. So if he sees a female, he will grab her. And grabbing means that both dragonflies and damselflies have specialized clasping organs at the end of their abdomen. And dragonflies have three of them, and damselflies have four, another way to tell them apart. And the dragonfly will fly at a female and actually land on her thorax, the part that holds the wings and legs, and hook his appendages onto her head, onto the top of her head. And when they are firmly hooked, then he lets go of the rest of her, and they fly off in tandem with the male in front of the female, holding on tightly to her. In damselflies, it varies a little. The male clasps the front of the thorax of the female right behind the head. So that's another really basic difference between the two groups. But in any case, they end up with the male in front and the female behind. They can then land somewhere, or even in flight in some cases. And if the female is receptive, which the great majority are, although not 100%, she will bend her abdomen around and touch the second segment under the abdomen of the male and basically contact that and be held by more clasping sort of things that the male has, and then mating takes place, copulation takes place. And this can be in the air briefly, it can be on a perch for a short time or for a very long time, lots of variation in that. The especially interesting thing, there are many interesting things about it, but one of them is that the male's copulatory organ is adapted to remove sperm from the female. So if the female has actually mated before, she will be carrying sperm from a previous mating, and the male's copulatory organ will actually, with the bristles and cups on the end of it, will actually remove all those sperm from her and deposit his own. And this fascinating thing of sperm competition or sperm displacement was actually first studied in damselflies. It was never known until it was studied in damselflies. Now it's been actually found in quite a few other kinds of animals, including things like rats and perhaps people.
Oh, my goodness me. I tell you, I was reading about that. I'm thinking, wow, we have to talk about that on the air. That was really fascinating. You know, we have emailed pictures from Gail and Jody and Dave. They sent three photos of dragonflies, and they're all beautiful photos. And one's dragonfly is a pretty light blue color. Another is gold, I would say, color. And the third is green. So here we have all these types, one after the other, that Wisconsin folks have taken photos of.
Sure. They come in all colors of the rainbow. I mean, that's a National Geographic article written on them way, way back, maybe in the 1950s, was called Dragonflies, Rainbows on the Wing. And that's what they are. They literally, I can't think of a color that some dragonfly or quite a few dragonflies don't display as they're flying around. Blue is a very, very common color. It turns out that we think that it may have evolved because it's very visible, and it evolved in males so that other males won't try to mate with them. You know, they're not, they're neat animals, but they have a brain the size of a head of a pin, and so they're not thinking animals. They're very, very responsive to stimuli, and so if a dragonfly sees another dragonfly about the right size, it's very likely to try to mate with it, even if it might turn out to be a male. So by evolving these really bright colors, males have actually evolved a way so that other males don't try to mate with them. They mate with the females, which aren't so brightly colored.
Very interesting. Anne in Green Bay, it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Well, I have two questions. First of all, I'm just wondering, with all the herbicides and these stupid mosquito squad sprays, how they're doing as a species. And then I'm just wondering if there's any dragonfly festivals in the state of Wisconsin.
Okay, the first question is actually one I can answer with some happiness, because dragonflies seem to be surviving what has been called the great insect apocalypse relatively well, probably because they eat anything. And that is, if some insect that was an important prey of dragonflies declines because of, just as you say, pesticide and habitat destruction and the many other things we're doing to the world, that dragonfly can just switch to another prey. So they're not as much affected as many, for example, leaf-eating insects or even butterflies are affected by pesticides and by things. Habitat destruction is a bad thing. If you dry up a wetland, those dragonflies are gone forever. Climate change is a bad thing, because one of the features of climate change, even if it's not happening in Wisconsin right now, is drought. And so drought dries up many, many wetlands, and that's definitely a very important common feature of climate change. But they're actually doing this. We only know of two species of dragonflies that have gone extinct in historic times. Almost surely many more have when tropical rainforests have been cleared in vast amounts, because a lot of rainforest dragonflies have very limited ranges. The second question was festivals. There are some dragonfly festivals scattered around the country, in New Mexico, in Texas, and California. Not sure about any in Wisconsin. There should be.
There are
a lot of people interested in dragonflies in Wisconsin.
There is one called the Dancing Dragonfly Winery Fall Harvest. And I think that might be the name of the winery, Dancing Dragonfly Winery. It's Fall Harvest Festival. So that, I don't know if they're, I imagine dragonflies are a part of it in some way. But that's the only one that I know about off the top of my head. But what I think about, you think about their popularity in terms of art and business. I mean, even there's, as you say in your book, there's even a clothing line called Dragonfly that's very popular.
There are several bands named Dragonfly. Dragonfly is just used everywhere. I live in Seattle, and I did a little search around my city, and I couldn't believe how many different businesses were named Dragonfly in one way or another. Sadly, Damselfly doesn't receive the same amount of publicity. There's hardly anything named Damselfly, but Dragonfly is very, very popular.
Yeah.
And it's in jewelry. It's in visual arts. There are so many dragonfly gewgaws you can't even imagine. I get a couple for Christmas every year.
Well, I tell you what, thanks for that call. Chuck in Lake Delton has something kind of relates to that, I think. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, thank you. Years ago when I was in Korea, the little kids, 6, 7, 8 years old, you know, they'd catch dragonflies, tie a string between their head and the rest of their body, and sell them on the street like helium balloons.
Oh.
Yes, I know of that.
Oh, you! Wow, that's something I'd never heard of. Does that still happen, Dennis? Do you know if that still happens?
That I don't know for sure, but in many Asian countries, dragonflies have been treated like that. Japan, it's amazing to go to Japan, to go to a city park and see little kids running around with insect nets, trying to catch dragonflies and other insects. We discourage that in this country because we're so concerned about bothering nature, at least in many educational situations. But in fact, I think little kids should be running around with insect nets, catching insects and learning about them.
Yeah, that makes some sense. Joe and Mercer emailed, to say he loves dragonflies, and he sent this absolutely fantastic photograph of a dragonfly in flight. He says it took him countless hours to get a nice, clear photo. It is absolutely beautiful and in perfect clarity as well. I wish you could see this one.
Dennis. I wish I could. I know that challenge very well because, of course, I'm always trying to photograph dragonflies in flight.
Oh, man. Doug in Madison, your turn. Hi, Doug.
So 10 or 15 years ago, my late wife was involved in a study of the Heinz Emerald and tagging the dragonflies. Am I correct that they exist primarily in the Niagara Escarpment? And what is the status of this dragonfly today?
Sure. Heinz Emerald is the only officially declared endangered species of dragonflies in North America. It's actually, once it was so declared because it was considered very rare, naturally, a lot of money was released to do studies on Heinz Emerald, and it was then found at lots and lots of additional places, and some of which it's actually common. So while not the most common and widespread dragonfly by any means, its populations seem to be very secure now, thanks to that designation of endangered species and all the money available for research. We should probably do that for more species.
Wow. Thank you, Doug, for calling. And I'm sorry about your wife. Tom in Cedarburg, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two quick points. I'm wondering, do dragonflies hunt deer flies? And also, a few years back, I was up by Land O'Lakes, and I saw a really big dragonfly at night, maybe 11 at night, on a window. And it was probably 5 inches across the wingspan. I've never seen one that big before or since, and I was wondering if you knew about that type of dragonfly.
Number one, I think they probably eat deer flies. Deer flies are very fast flying, evasive, I should say, creatures, as you probably know, trying to swat them. And dragonflies have been known to take them, so I assume they do. Again, like mosquitoes, they certainly don't control them, but they do eat them when they get a chance. There are probably more big dragonflies than you think around. You just don't see them. But usually when they're on a window, it's because they've been attracted. Often they've been flushed from their perch, for example, by some disturbance, and they fly around aimlessly and actually are attracted to lights just like moths are. There are a couple of pretty large species in that area. There's one called a dragon hunter. Which is so named because it actually hunts other dragonflies.
Oh, and aren't dragonflies considered the biggest insect ever, or am I mistaken?
There are creatures from long ago before the dinosaurs, which were much, much larger than present-day dragonflies. They were a side line of evolution. They weren't the line that directly gave birth to dragonflies themselves. They have been called griffin flies, G-R-I-F-F-I-N, and they're the biggest ones had a 27-inch wingspread. They probably weren't as fierce predators as the much smaller dragonflies of today, so at least you could walk into a carboniferous forest and not get attacked by one.
Oh, wow. And Tom, thank you again. Rob in Middleton, will go to you next. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I live in the country. My neighbor and I have about 20 acres of restored prairie. There's a couple small bodies of water within a mile of where I live. All summer and in early fall, I'll see an occasional damselfly or dragonfly. But occasionally, once or twice a summer, I will walk out, and they will be there in a localized area of my yard by the hundreds or at least many, many dozens. And I'm wondering what causes that. Is that a synchronous emergence of them from one of these bodies of water?
It could very well be. Quite a few species of both dragonflies and damselflies do emerge synchronously, often in the spring because they sort of build up over the winter in an advanced larval stage, and then when the water warms up enough in the spring for them to emerge, they all emerge at once. So you get that sort of synchronous emergence at the water. Sometimes also winds can play a part in that. A lot of Odonata at some water body, even at some distance, all of a sudden there's a very, very strong wind from that direction, and especially damselflies, which aren't such great flyers, can actually be blown by the winds.
Very interesting. Thank you, Rob, for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm taken, as are probably a lot of people, by the eyes of dragonflies that are so enormous. Do we know much about the makeup of the eye and how it's constructed?
Sure, we know a lot about it. Each of those eyes consists of hundreds to thousands of individual what we call ommatidia, the singular that is ommatidium. That's like a simple eye. And a large dragonfly may have 10,000 of those in either eye. And each of them has a lens. Each of them has something like a cornea. Each of them has a neuron that goes to the primitive brain. Again, not something they're thinking about, but something that they can respond to when something passes in front of that eye. Because there's lots and lots of simple eyes instead of an eye like we have, this compound eye records objects as a mosaic vision. So as for example, a tiny insect flying across the sky passes across the vision of that dragonfly, it doesn't just stimulate an eye once, it stimulates every single one of those simple eyes. So it's like, beep, 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 beep. So you wonder why they have no trouble at all tracking something like that.
Wow, that is really something. It's just kind of one of the interesting things about dragonflies, or one of them, you know, aside from the color, just the size of those eyes. And their vision, is it, can they see, they can't see 360 degrees, I don't imagine, but how?
Not quite. Their vision is poor below and behind. And if you're hunting dragonflies with an insect net, you know that very quickly. So you always want to try to swing from below and behind when you're trying to catch a dragonfly. I don't know if birds have learned about that or not, but birds are probably their most effective predators.
And as you were talking about, they're one of the oldest insect groups, are they not? Dragonflies and damselflies?
Yes, they are. They're, in terms of flying insects, they and mayflies are the oldest ones.
And they've, as you were talking about earlier, wondering why have they survived so long? But they're not plant eaters. I think
generalized predators probably is a pretty important reason. And in fact, just because they have survived so long, you kind of see that they must have evolved mechanisms to survive through a fair amount of change, of climate change, of all kinds of changes that have happened on the Earth.
And the book itself, Dennis, I imagine the book is available pretty much anywhere, is it not?
Sure. Sure it is, yeah. It's published by Ivy Press in the UK and Princeton in America, and I would always buy it from the publisher if I could, rather than making Amazon.com even richer. That was an unpaid announcement there.
Do you have a website? I did not notice.
Personally don't, but the Slater Museum of Natural History at the University of Puget Sound has a website, and on that is a very, very extensive. I was the director of that museum until I retired, and the Dragonfly website is still being carried there.
Well, I tell you what, this has been really great to have a chance to talk with you today, Dennis. Obviously, you know a whole lot about dragonflies, and obviously, what's your favorite one, by the way? Is there a favorite?
Well, I suppose it would be one called a blue-winged helicopter, which is that damselfly that has the largest wingspread of any odonate. It's a fairly common species in the rainforests of Costa Rica, where I have spent an awful lot of time, and it take your breath away when one flies by you. Take a look at it in the book.
Yeah, I will do that, Dennis. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure, Larry.
Dennis Paulson, and his book is called Dragonflies and Damselflies, A Natural History. Beautiful book with a lot of great information about both of those insects. Great talking with him. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.